Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 15th of June. Yesterday, the Kellogg Company said that it's going to phase out their ads on products to children under the age of 12 unless the foods meet specific nutrition guidelines for calories, sugar, fat, and sodium. The guidelines are these. One serving of food must have no more than 200 calories, no trans fat, no more than 2 grams of saturated fat, no more than 230 milligrams of sodium, and no more than 12 grams of sugar. Kellogg is also introducing Nutrition at a Glance, which is a label on the top right corner of cereal boxes. We're going to be talking about this hour of the program. This announcement came 16 months after Kellogg and Viacom were threatened with a lawsuit over their advertising to children. The lawsuit threatened by two groups. One is the co-founder of this organization is with us in a moment, the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, also the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and two Massachusetts parents, the lawsuit not proceeding as a result of Kellogg's announcement yesterday. We did invite somebody from Kellogg's to join us. They first said yes, and then they said no, so they won't be with us, but we are very happy to have Professor Diane Levin, who is with us now and is a founding member of Stop Commercial Exploitation of Children. Professor Levin is a professor of education at Wheelock College in Boston, where she's been involved in training early childhood professionals for over 25 years. She helps professionals and parents understand and counteract the harmful effects of violence, media, and commercial culture on children. She is the co-founder of Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, which prepares materials to help parents deal with media and commercial culture in their children's lives. She is also the author of 6 books, including Teaching Your Children in Violent Times, Building a Peaceable Classroom, and Remote Control Childhood, Combating the Hazard of Media Culture, and The War Play Dilemma. She is also working on a book, So Sexy, So Soon, The Sexualization of Childhood, and we hope to have her on as soon as that book is completed, because that would be a good talk show topic, I think. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her, and our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Diane Levin, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Were you surprised by the announcement, or did you, with negotiations with Kellogg's, feel that this was going to happen?
Well, I've been following the negotiations, and I know everyone involved was hopeful that this would happen, but the fact that it did has made everyone extremely jubilant that we've gotten to this stage. And we think it's really a precedent-setting agreement for really recognizing the fact that children are a group that needs to be protected in ways that haven't been happening for quite a while now.
Right. You see, I'm of the belief that children under 12, there just should be no advertising directed toward them. Why should there be? Why should we be advertising to children?
Well, thanks for saying that, because that's why we call it the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood.
Yeah.
And when often we're told, well, we're just dreaming that never could possibly happen, what we say is we want at least people to envision what that might look like and how it would be a better place for children, because children are really vulnerable for advertising messages in a way that adults are not nearly as susceptible to. And we've become pretty desensitized to the fact that life doesn't have to be this way, that what's happening to kids around marketing is really something that is not good for them and ultimately not good for all of us.
And the marketing is incredibly sophisticated, isn't it? It's not just commercials on television. It's in schools. It's also pretty elaborately designed to be a part of toys that children buy.
Exactly. And, in fact, my work on this whole topic began in the mid-'80s.
Oh, my.
And that is when I was doing work on war play and how children hear about violence and how does that connect to their war play. And teachers and parents both, but especially teachers, started saying, well, I've taught for 10 years or I've taught for 20 years and I didn't have that big a problem with war play in my classroom. I banned it and kids accepted the ban. And then suddenly we started hearing teachers saying, they don't accept it anymore. They're kids who are obsessed. We have guerrilla wars going on behind our backs. We don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that was when we started exploring it and found out children's television had been deregulated. The TV and toy industries immediately joined forces to market toys and TV shows together, and Some of your listeners may remember shows like Masters of the Universe, He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers. They were all shows that were developed right after deregulation, and they were enormously popular, and they really changed the nature of best-selling toys. Most of the best-selling toys since that time have been linked to the media.
Mm-hmm.
And then there started being all kinds of other products as well, from bed sheets to lunch boxes to breakfast cereals to Happy Meals. Everything began to be linked to the blockbuster media that was currently trendy. And it wasn't like that before the mid-80s, and most people don't remember it, but it's profoundly changed childhood, profoundly changed one of the areas I study, which is children's play. And increasingly, you know, food products have become the focus of concern because people are seeing the health effects on kids, but ultimately we're also going to have to look at the psychological effects.
Mm-hmm. Now, the common response to all of this, so let me ask it right off the bat, mm-hmm. Professor Levin, is that parents are the ones who go to the store. They're buying the food here. They're buying
exactly.
the toys. They don't have to buy this.
Right. Well, there's several responses, but one is I've actually seen industry memos that say if you're criticized, just tell everyone it's parents' responsibility, not yours. The industry works very hard to create that psyche in the public consciousness, to create that attitude. So I've interviewed thousands of parents, and most of them do say no to most things, but they can't say no to everything. And so some things get in, and if you're a parent, you'll say no to these 28 things, but not the other two. And some other family will say no to 28 other things, but it's a different 28 other things. So your child goes to another house to be exposed to those things. And it enters kids' lives whether parents say no or not. Certainly,
right.
There's an important role parents can play, and a lot of my work has been to help parents do that, but they can't do it on their own. It's like their finger's in a hole in the dike, and they try to keep the water from coming in, but they know some of it's going to get in, and they have to deal with it. So just saying no isn't the solution. The other thing, you mentioned marketing strategies, and it's gotten more and more and more sophisticated, so that now there are things like viral marketing. The industry will look for the most popular children in a school and offer their product to that
really?
Child.
Really?
Called viral marketing. And viral marketing, the idea is you plant the kind of venom, and it spreads, and it's a way to make products seem popular. Some research has been done on how to get children to nag their parents, how to advertise in ways that promote nagging for different age groups of children. Those are just two that kind of make me livid and really help keep me going in this work, because I just feel it's not fair, and I see all the harmful effects on children and families, like things like parents who notice that kids seem to be getting fresh and rebellious at younger ages. I call that premature adolescent rebellion. And there's all this effort to really get children to have their own subculture where products are really strong, so it's harder and harder for parents to say no.
Mm-hmm.
So we could go on and on and on about it, but it's very sophisticated. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. It's very hard for parents to compete with that kind of pressure.
So,
and that's one reason why this settlement is a real milestone. And, I mean, Kellogg has done this because it was a settlement agreement to avoid a lawsuit, which would have brought them much worse publicity. But the fact that they're doing it this way really gets them at the forefront of trying to say, yes, we're taking some responsibility as an industry. They didn't do it by choice, but the fact that they see this is what's going to serve their interest best
mm-hmm.
is really an important breakthrough.
Right. Who came up with these nutrition standards?
I haven't been involved in that piece. I think it was people at Center for Science and the Public Interest who actually have experts on child nutrition. They are working with them to develop those standards. Center for Science and the Public Interest was very active in working out that part of the settlement.
Mm-hmm. We asked Kellogg to be with us, and they were real excited about it at first, and then who knows what happened, but they said...
So you don't have any idea why they turned you down?
No, we don't know. They just said no, so we don't have a clue.
I guess they're getting such good press anyway,
they don't want to be subjected to phone calls, perhaps.
I'm actually speaking to you from England, and, you know, even here, it's beginning to... to be talked about, because obviously with globalization, hopefully it will gradually affect here.
Right. It was on national news, this story, last night.
Okay,
you're in England,
great.
So you may not know that. I saw it on national news.
So it's getting huge coverage then.
Yes, it is, which is good.
That's great, but we need to make sure it's the start rather than the end of this effort.
Yeah. I was surprised, though, when Kellogg said, because this still seems to me to be a huge percentage of advertising. Today, only 27% of Kellogg advertising spending in the U.S. is directed to children under 12. That seems to me to be a huge percentage of advertising.
Right, when they say only, right. I don't know the ultimate number, but any parent who's watched, you know, children's television with their children know that Kellogg's products figure very prominently. So it's still huge. And there's all the other kinds of marketing that they do. They recently have begun marketing kind of curriculum, donating curriculum materials to preschools that had the logos and various other positive things associated with their products to start getting it. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion lately about marketing in schools. And in fact, Massachusetts, this past 2 weeks ago, held hearings on a new bill that's, I think, the most far-reaching in the nation to ban marketing in schools. And in part, I mean, Steve's Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood was involved in that, and I testified at the hearings. And there was a huge amount of interest in it, I think, nationally, because marketing in schools is becoming a bigger and bigger force, and Kellogg's has been very present within that. And what hadn't happened that much before was marketing in preschools. You know, the attitude being the younger you get the child to be loyal to your products, the more of your products and the more years they're going to be buying them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been going on. So this is a big step to begin to think about marketing in schools and to be taking it out for Kellogg, what had been a new growth industry for them to say they're not going to do it anymore is a big step for them.
Right. Tell me more about this. I am just flabbergasted to hear you talk about picking the popular students in school. What do they get, free cereal for a lifetime or what?
Well, I've heard about it more with older kids. It hadn't filtered down too far. I mean, I don't know how young it had filtered down, but for instance, when a new video game would come out, they would give it to middle school kids. You know, who's the popular middle school kid? They give them a free copy of the game in exchange for the kids saying, oh, it's cool, I really love it, so everyone else would want to go out and buy it. I've heard of it happening for birthday parties, you know, offering to help a child have a themed birthday party. And I don't know which companies have done it. I just know about the practice. And so that a popular girl would have a birthday party for X current popular thing, and it would lead to all the other girls wanting to have the same kind of party.
Wow.
That kind of marketing has gone on, say, in the older part, like the post-adolescent young adult segment. It may have begun there, where they would actually pay young women to be at bars to order drinks, you know, and talk about how wonderful they were as a way of marketing some new drink product to the men in the bar.
Do we need to go to Congress? Have you gone to Congress, Professor Levin, and said, we need to look again at what the effects have been of deregulation of children's television?
We've constantly, I mean, there have been many efforts to do that through Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood, through another organization called Commercial Alert. But in the current climate, the idea of government playing any role has been very, very difficult. I know that about 5 or 6 years ago, I testified before the Senate Commerce Committee on the marketing of violence to children, which is where I've been putting a lot of my time at that point. And there was a huge amount of, the idea was, it was a Republican-led committee at that point, and the idea was if we shame industry enough, they'll do something responsible. And in effect, this Kellogg's decision is rather like that,
mm-hmm.
except that it's very much turning things, I mean, it's doing things more extreme than anyone expected they would do on their own. But the idea that there has been this kind of, these kinds of things going on with children is nothing new.
Yeah. We're going to take phone calls. We're talking about a settlement announced yesterday with the Center for a Child-Free, Commercial-Free Childhood and the Center for Science in the Public Interest, this settlement announced with Kellogg announcing major restrictions in the way they will market food to children. And as a result of that, the organizations and two Massachusetts parents will not proceed with a planned lawsuit against Kellogg. Our guest organization says the new policy doesn't go as far as they would like, but they believe all advertising should be targeted to parents and not children. But it's a tacit admission that the advertising practices favored by the food industry have had a powerful influence on children's food choices and have had a negative effect on children's health and well-being. For far too long, the food industry has denied that marketing is a factor in children's consumption of unhealthy foods. We're welcoming phone calls from you. I think we'll get jammed with calls. And take this a little farther if you want, Kellogg's decision, but also the deregulation of children's television and the massive amounts of advertising that go to children who are under the age of 12 and whether or not that is necessary and how it influences them. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Diane Levin, professor of education at Wheelock College in Boston, where she's been involved in training early childhood professionals for over 25 years. She is also a founding member of TRUCE, Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, and Stop Commercial Exploitation of Children. To your phone calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655 for Professor Diane Levin. Second hour of our program, living up to our name, the Ideas Network. Here are some ideas. The May-June issue of Foreign Policy has 21. It's really an interesting issue of the magazine, 21 Solutions to Save the World. They asked 21 leading thinkers what is one solution that would make the world a better place and then included all their answers. We're going to be talking with Howard Gardner, who's a professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And let me just plant this idea in your mind because, you know, mull it over, and then you can tell us what you think of it the second hour. He says that one thing that we could do is no individual should be allowed to accumulate in an estate more than 50 times the allowed annual income. Thus, no person would be permitted to pass on to his or her beneficiaries more than $200 million. Anything in excess must be contributed to charity or donated to the government. There's another interesting idea we'll talk about with Howard the second hour of the show. All right, let's go to phone calls. Yesterday, the Kellogg Company going to phase out its ads on products to children under the age of 12 unless foods meet specific nutrition guidelines. This in response to a threatened lawsuit by two organizations, one of whom was founded by our guest, the Stop Commercial Exploitation of Children. 800-486-8655. We go to, is it Winna from Delafield?
Yes, it is. Galesville.
From where?
Galesville.
Oh, you're from Galesville. Okay.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks. My son is in kindergarten, and we have not had him watch television shows, only videos, because there's no commercials in the videos, and we've always chosen the really gentle ones. And we really like Nick Jr. programs, but it seems like kids only watch those when they're 2 or 3 years old, and then they move on to the violent shows. All the other boys in his kindergarten loved Star Wars, and we just couldn't even believe that a five-year-old would already have seen Star Wars. Mm. They'd always play it and act it out on the playground and ask, and they would be playing with lifesavers because they don't know how to say lightsaber.
Oh.
And they would ask him to play, and he would say no. He was really the oddball of not playing Power Rangers or any of those shows connected with those toys and not having any of those toys. He's definitely the odd man out with the boys. He said the girls don't like to play that either, but that all the boys did. And they used to have Nick Jr. on Saturday mornings on CBS here, and there wouldn't be any commercials except at the end of the show, so you could just turn it off. And now they've switched to some older girls' sleepover program that they show instead. So We're just sticking with videos at our house.
Mm-hmm. Did you complain when that switch was made?
No, I guess I don't even really know how mm-hmm. to go about doing that. CBS national decision.
Yeah, Professor Levin will teach you that, I'm sure, because I'm going to ask her to do that in a moment. You got to make your voices
right.
heard.
I mean, there's several important issues you raised there. One is parents who you're a wonderful example of a parent who is really thinking a great deal about what's best for your child and trying to help resist the popular culture and the commercial pressures that are put on you and your son. And it becomes a big struggle when children enter school and they're part of a wider community. And that's one reason why I talked about it's like your finger's in a hole in the dike and you try to keep the water out, but you know it's going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So in part, it depends on how your son is feeling about being the odd boy out, whether it's hard for him or whether he's comfortable with it. But many parents find at this stage they do have to start letting a little more in thoughtfully with their child and being involved with it, talking about it, helping their child
right.
understand it, so that they're gradually being kind of fortified to be a part of the culture that surrounds them.
But he doesn't like it either, so.
So when that's the case, it's supporting him in those efforts.
Right.
Some parents say at this point kids start putting more pressure on them. Until your son does, I think, to kind of support him and help him develop his interests and friendships where he's comfortable is really very positive.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how to protest when something happens that's on the air that you don't like or mm-hmm. it changes, the group that I founded, Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment, T-R-U-C-E,
okay.
Truth, as in Making Peace, that organization has a website called truceteachers.org. And on that website, we have a media violence action guide. It's in the process of being revised, but in there, it lists phone numbers, and it kind of has sample letters, and it suggests ways that parents can call up or write to complain. We knew in the Boston area when we started preparing the guide that the TV stations considered one phone call equal to 5,000 viewers because they got so many
phone calls. Oh, my
gosh.
Wow.
I mean that they do, you know, once they get 5 or 10 calls, they start taking it seriously
mm-hmm.
so that it would be ask friends to call, do it yourself, and really create a little network of activists there can make a huge difference. And it's not just the national network. The local station has some control over what they end up showing.
Okay, great. I have one follow-up. And just assuming that parents always say no to these things, I think it's been going on long enough that parents in the 80s who grew up with this and had fun and liked it say yes to their
right.
kids.
Right, because I was talking earlier about deregulation, and the first deregulation generation, who were kind of children in the mid-80s, are now the parents of the young children who are entering school, and for sure they were part of that culture. They liked that culture, and that's one reason why there's been a reissue 3 years ago of Masters of the Universe. All the ones that were really popular with the parents are now coming back. It's an effort to kind of capture the market again. The other thing is, you mentioned that by age 5, children are involved with Star Wars, and that's often called by the industry age compression. How to kind of move things that used to be for 10-year-olds down to 8-year-olds, what was for 8-year-olds down to 5-year-olds. And you may notice that the Star Wars movie is rated PG-13, but their products being marketed for 4-year-olds. And in part, that's because when people see an age rating on a toy, they think, oh, you know, some expert knows what's good for my child. Well, the fact is the industry can put just about any age rating they want on a toy based on what they think they can get away with. There's something on a toy that says children 12 months and under or 24 months and under. They're small parts, so it's not suitable. That's an agreement by the industry, but there's always an age recommendation for the toy, and each company decides for each toy what they can get away with. To put there, especially when there's these mass-marketed toys. So don't go by the age ratings, but you'll see a PG-13 movie, as Star Wars is, with a toy for 4-year-olds, which makes parents think, well, the toy's okay, and that makes kids think, then the movie's okay. So it's one way that movies like Star Wars have become such a part of a culture of young children that it shouldn't be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it makes you wonder who these people are who are doing this, Professor Levin. Like, how can you sit at a table and design all of this without thinking about whether or not it's good for children when chances are you've got children as well?
Well, see, it's part of the lore of the capitalist system and how it works. Your job when you're making the movie or you're making the toy is to make a profit for your company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like there's this disassociation. You know, you have your personal life and you have your work life, and the values don't always connect. Someone like Steven Spielberg had said after Jurassic Park came out, well, of course he wouldn't let his young son watch it. You know, I think he was 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
But there were toys being marketed for 4-year-olds to go with it. So there's a disconnect there.
Right.
He said he wouldn't let his son go, so then, you know, well, why would any parent let their son go? But he doesn't control all the marketing that's going on for 4-year-old toys that he's making money from.
Right, right.
So it's a very complicated process. And it's interesting with the Kellogg decision for one company to decide it's in their self-interest to do this. That's what's the big breakthrough, because in the past, the self-interest was to kind of do the most aggressive thing you could get away with to sell the most products through unscrupulous means. And it's happened. I know I talked to Lego people at the Lego company years and years and years ago when they had no weapons or anything else in their toy line, and they were really struggling after deregulation. And gradually now people will know that Lego is linked to many media events, including Star Wars, because they gradually, in order to survive, they thought that was the way they were lured in.
Right.
And that's happened with many companies. So it's not just a matter of them saying no. It's how the system is working, that the more aggressive you are, the more money you make. And, and that's why, just going back to your mentioning the government control, I think absolutely it's time for government to rethink its role in protecting children. Industry has the public and government convinced that it's a First Amendment issue. We can't limit the freedom of speech of corporations. But the country has a long history of protecting children, from drinking, from driving, from abuse, from tobacco. You know, there are any number of examples where children have been protected. And this is a place where we feel, certainly it's easier, people have listened more when we're talking about junk food as a result of the health epidemic we're having in the country now. But if you talk about violence, if you talk about marketing of using sexiness as the way of marketing with younger and younger children, to think about what's the link up between marketing and media is just a crucial, crucial thing that government has a role in.
Right. Do you think because Kellogg did take this action, other companies will follow suit and soon?
I don't know. That's certainly my hope, that it becomes seen as the high ground thing to do and the thing that gets you more public visibility. And certainly Kellogg has scooped other manufacturers by being the one. It's not going to be such a hot story. The next company that does it and the third company that does it will get even less press.
Mm-hmm.
So once it's less newsworthy, I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Let's go to George next. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Pretty good. Actually, I was going to talk about this, but one comment I'd like to make immediately is that Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and anyone in Hollywood has incredible control over how things are marketed.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
I work in the child care field in an R&R, but my second jobs have all tended to be freelance writing and also tied to like a lot of things in popular culture.
Uh-huh.
And so I know a lot of people in this business. I had a close friend of mine who wrote a novel, sold it, he didn't sell it. I mean, his agent sold it to Hollywood. When they did the novelization, they changed, of course, the book in order to do the movie. They did the novelization. He got the novelization rights. He could not determine what was going to be in the novel. They edited him word by word to make sure he was near the script. He had no creative control over writing the novelization of his own movie. So a guy like Spielberg and Lucas, have major control, and they pitch these things in incredible ways. You know, before the movie's released, they're pitching the rights to these things. And I think the most interesting aspect of this that needs to be made as a differentiation is the corruptive aspect to the creative process. And I say that because growing up in the 50s, we were surrounded by toys that were related to movies and television shows and comic books. But what tended to happen is that Bugs Bunny wasn't designed to sell toys. Bugs Bunny was designed by a group of animators who had specific types of stories and things that they wanted to do, and pretty much because they were a low-rent operation, had pretty much free rein and did these cartoons. They're still being watched, you know, 60 years later.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big difference between starting that process, similar to even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where you have two people who basically create something that people find interesting, and then ultimately toys are spun off, to, I think, a lot of the modern processes where you come up with, like, a comic book idea, and before the publisher's going to look at it, they're quite often going to be looking at, well, you know, does the guy have a vehicle we can sell as a toy? How many parts can be taken off of the costume? I think the difference between the first round of George Lucas movies in terms of Star Wars was that he was telling stories he really wanted to tell. The third ones, I haven't even seen all the last third ones, in spite of years ago enjoying the first three, but I gave up after the first of the new one. Jar Jar Binks and stuff like that comes out of a thing of, well, you know, we're going to make X number of profits if we have X number of action figures.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create a host of characters that mm-hmm. are essentially put in the story process, and the story then and what you're trying to do to entertain becomes secondary to the whole marketing process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, has had a major impact on, you know, I mean, granted, it's low-end popular culture junk entertainment, but I think you've had a major impact on how those stories are taken and how they're adapted. I mean, even adult stuff like Hellblazer, you know, when I saw the movie, and the comic book is quite interesting and very complex, the movie, they were adding things like guns that shot super, you know, silver bullets and all sorts of other things, so that stuff in turn could be possibly spun off and marketed.
Professor Levin.
Yes, you point out a very important thing. Star Wars, the original Star Wars, became the model for marketing a line of toys that replicated everything you saw on the screen. They could do that because television was regulated, but movies weren't. It was enormously successful, and that was the motivation for deregulating television. And it's why as soon as deregulation happened, there were whole lines of toys replicating everything you saw on the screen that went with shows like Masters of the Universe and Transformers. What I did at that time was document children's play and how it changed. And what we were seeing was children's play all over the world was exactly the same. It wasn't creative. It wasn't imaginative. When they played Ninja Turtles, every child did karate chops and running mm-hmm. around, mm-hmm. and it never changed and evolved. And as someone, myself, who studied children's play and its importance therapeutically and cognitively for kids' learning and emotional well-being, it was really, really worrisome, especially when so much of what they were focusing on was violent. So, I mean, both you're saying, George is saying that, you know, that the actual creative process is disappearing from the product that's being developed, but from the point of view of children, the creative process is also disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And for children, it's had huge impact in terms of children who, when you give them open-ended toys that they used for generations, Play-Doh blocks, they often get bored very quickly because they don't know how to come up with their own problems. They're used to having a toy that says, when you play this, you push this button, and it does that.
Right, right.
And more toys are like that, and they look like they're going to be exciting, but they get boring very quickly. So children look on the back of the box for the next toy, and it's also a marketing technique. If toys are really boring, you just need more and more and more. And parents who I've interviewed talk about how they have a whole room full of toys for their children, and their kids always say they're bored.
Mm-hmm.
But the more of those toys they have, the more they're going to need.
More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with Professor Diane Levin, and we're talking about a number of issues. Our conversation prompted by the announcement yesterday from the Kellogg Company that's going to phase out ads on products to children under the age of 12 unless the foods meet specific nutrition guidelines for calories, sugar, fat, and sodium. The announcement a little over a year after Kellogg was threatened with a lawsuit over their advertising to children by two groups, one of those groups founded by our guest this hour, Stop Commercial Exploitation of Children, and also the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and two Massachusetts parents. The lawsuit will not proceed now. We're looking at advertising to children and how really, according to our guest, it has changed the whole nature of childhood. And we're welcoming phone calls. What do you think about the Kellogg decision? Do you applaud this? Do you think that there needs to be more government regulation of children's television, or will advertisers be shamed eventually into advertising the right thing, or perhaps, although this is not likely to happen, not advertising to children? Welcoming your calls. Couple lines are open. You're kind of quiet on this. I thought you'd have a lot to say. Maybe you will the next part of the show, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We did invite Kellogg's to be on this show. They initially said yes, and then we don't know why they said no. So just so you know that. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, 21 Solutions to Save the World, found in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Now our lines are jammed on this, so thanks for all your calls, everybody. Professor Diane Levin is our guest, professor of education at Wheelock College in Boston. She's been training early childhood professionals for a number of years, teaches courses on play, media, and violence prevention, and she is the author of a number of books. She's the co-founder of Teachers Resisting Unhealthy Children's Entertainment. She's also a co-founder of the Coalition for a Commercial-Free Childhood. She's the author of a number of books, including Teaching Young Children in Violent Times, Building a Peaceable Classroom, Remote Control Childhood, Combating the Hazard of Media Culture, and The War Play Dilemma. Currently working on the book So Sexy, So Soon, The Sexualization of Childhood. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And we go to Crystal from Oshkosh next. Hi, Crystal.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a mother of a four-year-old girl, and her father and I have regulated what kind of products she uses as far as, you know, she's not allowed to wear little girl makeup, and she's not allowed to buy Bratz dolls. And it's kind of gotten to the point when we're toy shopping that she says, well, mom and dad don't let me buy Bratz dolls. And it's kind of getting to that point of contention, and I've reached the point where I just ignore it because I really don't want it to be a power struggle, but it seems like in us regulating what kind of products she cannot use, that it's kind of bringing her attention to those things and almost making it seem like that's forbidden fruit.
What's the name of the dolls? I'm not familiar with them.
The reason that we don't let her buy them because they dress very promiscuously.
Oh, my.
She was given a stack of books once, and we went through them, and there was a Bratz paper dolls book, and I just flipped through it, and the shorts came up above the crotch line. They were tank tops, midriff, heavy eyeshadow and makeup. And for a four-year-old girl, I just think that's way too sensual.
Right. Not very appropriate.
Exactly. And it's in the same aisle, you know, we try to buy her toys like Polly Pockets and pet toys that are more focused on play and girl play rather than teenage play. But you'll see right in the same aisle Bratz dolls that, you know, and she notices them, and she notices other girls playing with them. And so, you know, it really has become kind of an illicit pleasure for her to, you know, see them in stores.
Right. All right, well, Professor Levin.
Well, Crystal, you are not alone. There are many, many parents struggling with what to do about breast cells because even though, Kathleen, you should learn about them because their sales actually surpassed sale of Barbies last year.
Oh, my gosh. I will learn about them, yeah.
They now have their own TV show, and they now have their own line of clothing, which includes bikini underpants and padded bras
for
young children. And it's having
the work I'm doing right now on So Sexy, So Soon, breasts are certainly a central issue when you deal with this issue with young children. So the struggle that you're having is one you shouldn't have to have, but good for you for having it. But then one of the sections in my book, Remote Control Childhood, talks about how why just saying no isn't enough. Because as your daughter is being exposed to this kind of stuff, we need to begin to find ways to influence and talk about and stay connected about the about what's going on with it. Because what happens is if we cut ourselves off too much, they'll go around playing it at other houses, and they'll see it as something that you just don't bring home. And so they're learning things about being sexy that they end up just having to figure out on their own without the help of a caring, loving parent.
And it's pretty hard to figure.
It's a terrible struggle.
You can't figure that out when you're 6 or 5. Well, really?
Right. You can't start. I mean, you can't figure it all out, but you can begin to talk about, well, what do you like about the doll? And this is, you know, how come you like it so much? See, in part, young children's thinking, the way they think, makes them focus on the most extreme, dramatic, concrete things in their environment. So that's why for years things got more and more and more violent for boys. You know what? Suddenly what I saw in 1990 that I thought was upsetting, in 2000 when I looked at it, I thought, please give it back to me because it's so much less bad than what's there now. It keeps escalating. Well, if you look at Barbie dolls, that's happened too. People used to be upset about Barbies in some ways because of the focus on appearance, and so Barbie, you know, changed a little bit. But now there's My Scene Barbie and Bling Bling Barbie, which is trying to compete with Bratz dolls, which become more and more sexualized, shorter and shorter. And with what happens is kids do use toys because they focus on how things look. One, if it's extreme, they're going to be drawn to it. So they're drawn to Bratz because they're the most extreme-looking, sexy things. But then when they get a toy like that, it's very hard to use it in any other way but the way it looks. So what they're going to do is have fashion shows and go on dates before they really understand either. And, in fact, I was in Belfast, Northern Ireland, talking about So Sexy, So Soon in March. And with the whole room of early childhood professionals, I said, have you seen girls play with Bratz dolls? And they all said yes. What have you seen them play? And they could only tell me two things. In all of their experience, they had seen girls do, and one was dressing up for fashion shows, and the other was dressing up for dates. So it gets kids focused on, once kids are focused on dressing up, then for girls at younger and younger ages, what they're wanting is to buy clothes and focusing on appearance and just dropping play, stopping play altogether and just focusing on appearance. So there's a press release has been put out in the last week that Barbie's about to release a whole new line of makeup that's really for girls. Instead of even playing with your doll. More and more they're turning girls into the dolls and into the sexy object.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy. Could you please, I'm sorry to be so out of touch with this, but how do you spell the name of this doll? I'm still not getting it.
B is in boy, R, A, T is in Tom, Z, the last letter of the alphabet.
Bratz dolls. Okay.
But even the name upsets some parents for good reason.
Yeah.
And... you know, there's all kinds of ways where they're pushing the envelope like that to be racy.
Thank you very much, Crystal, for your call. Let's go next to Carolyn from Beloit. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for letting me be on your show. I grew up in the late 80s on a farm, three older brothers. I was the last kid by about 5 years, so most of my toys were hand-me-down G.I. Joes and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I tell you, most of our playing wasn't karate chops or anything. It was burying it in the sandbox and then filling it with water and, you know, far from what the intended use was. But my mom really tried to keep us away from the toys, but more the commercial side of it. Most of our playing was done outside or making Play-Doh and, you know, making our own activities. And I think it allowed for us all to be a lot more creative. I myself am an artist now, but I'd like to see that come back. I've seen, my niece is 4 years old, and I've seen the, my sister-in-law's done a good job of keeping away from the toys, but just for her birthday, she got one of those, you know, short shirt, short skirt, lots of makeup toys, and, you know, we'd never get it for her, but she's getting it for her birthday present. Try to promote making her own toys, making puppets, making their own activity.
That's terrific. I mean, one of the things that when we think about how can we deal with the culture, one of the most important ways is to help children become good players despite what's going on. Because if you have a child who's really learned how to play creatively, as you're describing, you can have a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle toy and use it to bury it in the sand or take it in the bathtub or do interesting things. So that's one of the best fortifications we can kind of help children have to resist that kind of the part that just lures them into imitating and replicating. So that's terrific. And, I mean, that in terms of girls who do get a Bratz doll when the parent didn't want it, if they're a good player, they're more likely to be able to expand what they can do with it, especially with the help of an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for years I tried to help parents think how to transform the violent play into play that's more creative and not just focusing on violence. I mean, one thing that's interesting with the sexual stuff, we all can agree with the violent stuff that we want to try to discourage violence and violent behavior. The sexual issue, the sex and sexiness issue, is a more complicated one because we want kids to learn healthy ideas and attitudes about it. We don't want them to think it's bad. But the messages they're getting now very much undermine that kind of healthy development because they learn to treat themselves and others as objects. How you look and what you can buy to look right determines your value and how you judge yourself and how you judge others. And the more we objectify ourselves, the more we're not learning how to interact positively and connectedly with other people. And that's what we need to do to be able to grow up to have healthy relationships where sex is a part.
Yeah.
So what worries me so much about what's happening with things like the Bratz doll is that it's really undermining kids' ideas about what relationships are and what's important in a relationship. And adults can do a great deal, even if their child has a Bratz doll, to help their children learn about positive, caring relationships.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Alan from Fox Point. Hi, Alan.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I had a couple things to say. But the first thing is to talk about what the last discussant was talking about the socialization of children and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big problems that children are having nowadays is that the social is emphasized too much. Instead of teaching children about the material world and their environment and how to live in it, we talk about social things all the time, social things in their play, social things in their relationships. And the emphasis on the social is too great for the children growing up. We should be talking about the relationship to the material world, the world around them. And instead of teachers talking about the big social problems of global warming all over the world, they should be talking about the world right around the children, the environment here, teaching them about what their woods still look like, what the birds are, and so forth and so on. And we're so lost in the social.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Professor Levin.
That's a really important point, Alan. And I don't think they're unrelated. I think that, in part, children are having, first of all, people are focusing so much on the social because kids are having such a hard time with the social. In part, they're having such a hard time with the social because of many of the issues we've been talking about so far. So much of children's experience today is secondhand experience. It's from watching television instead of being outside, learning about nature, being involved with the natural. The fact is children learn best by hands-on experiences, and they're having fewer and fewer of them. So there is a crisis of nature, and there's a whole group that's forming at this point to try to think about how to bring nature education and nature experience back into the lives of children. But, I mean, so the fact that
there's so much talk about the social, if children aren't interacting with each other as much, if when they play they're not kind of having the creative exchanges and developing the creative things, even if it's playing with leaves and pretending, you know, they're going around and you know, doing things in the sand with them or with water and just creating their own activities. When children are doing that together, they're problem solving, they're working out disagreements, they're shaping things together, they're cooperating. And if they're just going around when they're not involved with the screen, imitating what they've seen on the screen, that opportunity for them to develop interest in the real world and skills for interacting with each other have really been reduced. So I think we need to look at it, you know, to pick up on your point, Alan, I think we need to look at it as connected and how to reconnect kids with hands-on experiences. There was a TV show that I consulted on that's still on occasion, that's still being produced, that was designed to be a science show for preschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was really to get them back involved with interacting with the real world. Every show had some kind of challenge that the characters in the show were struggling with, and then it showed real children trying those things out in the real world. The idea being, how do we get kids playing in the bathtub again with sink and float objects, which they don't do anymore?
On that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you. We'll be in touch with you again to talk about the sexualization of childhood. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Levin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Diane Levin, and we're talking about commercials in children, conversation prompted by Kellogg Company going to phase out ads on products to children under age 12 that don't meet nutrition guidelines. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Sharome Owens for on-air production, and thanks everybody for your calls on the Ideas Net.